Breakfast.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Tomorrow is Election Day in two congressional districts, including one just over the state line in South Carolina. We will preview that vote later in the hour. First, the Foundation for the Carolinas has become a driving force in the Charlotte area on a range of issues, from the arts and education to the environment and social services. It's also working to transform downtown, including a renovation of the Carolina Theater. Along with this widening influence, the foundation's assets have seen rapid growth. That started nearly 60 years ago with a $3,000 grant, now has a record $2 billion in assets. So what's driving all this? And also, what exactly is the foundation? WFAE's David Borak spent weeks profiling the foundation and its work in the community, and he joins us in this first part of the program. Good morning, David.
Hello, Mike.
We hear about the Foundation for the Carolinas all the time for various different reasons. So what is it?
Well, it's one of Charlotte's oldest community institutions, Mike. And as you mentioned, it was founded in 1958. They got a $3,000 grant from another charity in town, the United Way. And the idea at that time was to build up an endowment. You know, that's a permanent source of money that's invested and grows enough every year so that they have money that they can use for other purposes, in this case, for charitable giving. And it grew pretty slowly for many years during its history. I think it only hit $1 million in 1976. In 2012, it hit $1 billion. And in 2016, as you mentioned, it hit $2 billion. And, you know, that's a huge number for a community foundation. It ranked 35th when the CEO, Michael Marsicano, came in 1999. And it now ranks 8th in the U.S. among similar kinds of community foundations. It actually ranks 6th, according to Michael Marsicano's own numbers, which he compiles by talking to other folks in his business. And the other piece of this is that they gave away last year $300 million to all those charities in the areas that you mentioned. And about $10 million of that came from the foundation's funds itself. And those go to all kinds of causes in the 13-county area around Charlotte. And, you know, there's a couple of ways you can describe it. It is a charitable foundation. It raises money and it gives it away, but it's a really complex one. It's actually a collection of about 2,500 funds that come from all kinds of people. I talked to Marsicano about this, and he told me what the foundation is.
Some of those are individuals and families who place dollars into funds in their name, and then over time they make grants out of those funds to the causes they care about. We also hold corporate foundation dollars, where corporations have decided to use our services. And we also hold nonprofit endowments.
So you think of it like a bank. You know, it's a nonprofit bank, but one that gives away money to charitable causes in all those areas that you mentioned. It actually works a little bit like a mutual fund or your retirement account. They get fees from the people who put their money with them, and it's less than 1% per year. The other piece of it is that it provides services to all of these people who have money. And they, you know, they could give this money away themselves. They could write their own checks, but many of them don't really feel like they can do that. And they use the foundation services for investment management, record keeping, marketing, and meeting planning, and all those sort of things. So,
for the average person, this sounds very complicated. What you're saying is that the money doesn't just go in there and sit in a safety deposit box. They actually invest this money so that it can grow over time. Does that explain how they went from $1 billion in assets in 2012 to $2 billion just a few years later?
Yeah, that's part of it. You know, this growth has been rapid in the past 4 years, and I think a big piece of that was the stock market, which has been rising. It's boosted fund values, and it's also spurred people to give new donations and set up new funds at the foundation. Also, a couple of other things are driving that growth. More nonprofits have picked the foundation to manage their endowments, and the foundation has come up with lots of new ways to give. Like, they have a fund where if you own a private business, you can put an interest or shares of your small private business into this fund and get a tax credit for it, and they will invest it for you, and then you can decide where to give it away later.
Hmm. Why did you decide to do this story now?
It's a great question. You know, I've been following the foundation for many years. I've been in Charlotte for about 25 years, and it seemed like in the past decade or so, you know, one of the big events in the philanthropic scene in Charlotte every year was the Foundation for the Carolinas annual meeting every spring, usually around March. And so I got invited one year to go to this, and I've gone to it every year for the past few years. And I just got very interested. You know, the room is full of people whose names you would know from Charlotte who are the clients of the fund, of the foundation, Belks and Blumenthal's and people like that. And they're people who built businesses. And then there are a lot of people there who maybe don't have money yet, but they are, you know, the people who aspire to join the kind of well-off class in Charlotte. And I just got interested. You know, it's a big concentration of wealth and power in that room. And the other reason that I decided to take it on right now, of course, is that rapid growth. I wanted to find out what's going on here. Why is it growing so fast?
So that was going to be one of my questions. It seems this is a united way for the well-heeled, in other words. And I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean that this is a lot of money going to various different causes over time, but a lot of money as opposed to what the average person can put in. Do you have to have is there an income floor that or an asset floor that you need to consider donating to them?
I don't know that there's any kind of a minimum to get in, but I think it's people who have come into money. You know, I had several people describe it to me this way. There are people who have had success in their businesses or have inherited money that they have that is sitting there, and they realize that they have more than they need, and they would like to give some of it away. And you know, it sounds like a simple thing to give money away, but when you think about it, like, how do I go about doing that? I mean, you can write only so many, you know, $1,000 checks to charity, but people want to have a bigger effect. I mean, if you had $1 million to give away, you'd want to have it do something meaningful and have an impact. And I think a lot of people are looking at it that way, and they want somebody to help them. And so the foundation has really been that for them. And, you know, they have put their trust and their money with the foundation to do that. And, you know, I talked to this guy, Peter Keen, in Charlotte, who's been a foundation client for about 10 years, and he talked to me about why he did it. I mean, he initially thought about setting up his own foundation, and then he realized, oh, man, I'm in business. I don't want to do this myself. I don't really know it. Here's what he told me.
This is a new world to me, and I think it is for a lot of entrepreneurs in Charlotte. They have their head down. They're doing whatever they do that they're passionate about, and then one day, if they're fortunate, they wake up and they realize they have the capacity to give back, but not necessarily the knowledge to give back intelligently.
I think that's the key there. Oh, go ahead, Mike.
No, I was just going to say go ahead and finish your thought.
I was just going to say, you know, the key there is that these are people who they really want to do good with their money, and they are good at what they do, but like so many things in life, there are things that we're not good at. We're not experts at them. And so Peter Keen and other clients like him said, you know, we're going to trust the foundation to do that. And I think one of the aspects of the foundation's growth in recent years has been Michael Marsicano's ability to sell the foundation to all of these families. And what he's selling them is something that does all the things they need, something they can trust, something that will grow. And he's selling them a way to have an impact in the community. And that's another important point here, is that there are lots of places to put your money. There are lots of places to give it away. There are national causes. A lot of people who are involved with the foundation are here specifically because they want to give to local causes, and they want to see their money have an impact in the Charlotte community.
And you report that even as the Foundation for the Carolinas is gaining in assets and in terms of notoriety and notice on the part of people who have money to donate, organizations like United Way, maybe even the Arts and Science Council, have been losing in popularity. Why is that? Is one offsetting the other?
Well, I don't know that there's a one-to-one connection between these, but at least when it comes to people who have money, I think it's partly that they are thinking about it in a more sophisticated way. You know, it used to be you'd give a big chunk of money to a charity and say, go do what you want with it. But many donors these days would like to see their money have an impact, as I said, and they want to put it somewhere where maybe they have a little more influence over what happens to it.
Well, let's talk about the impact. What has been the impact?
Well, there's lots of ways you can measure it, as many charities as there are in the Charlotte region. I mean, so many of the nonprofits in our area have benefited from money that has come through the Foundation for the Carolinas. And, you know, what we're talking about here is not the foundation itself giving a single donation to a nonprofit, but all of these many fund holders, these families and corporate foundations that are looking for places to give, will pick their own charities to give to. I mean, not everybody gives to all the charities under the foundation's wing. And so they can, you know, the reason that many of these families do it is that they do get a tax deduction in addition to seeing their money go to work. And they can put their money into one of these funds at the foundation right now, get a tax deduction today for it. And then later on, over the years, as they see it, they can give money away. And many of them do this. They sort of have a little family board, for example. I talked to somebody who said, you know, it's him and his wife and their kids are involved in this ever since the kids were teenagers. And they're kind of growing another generation of donors to nonprofits. And they are deciding where this money goes individually. So the $300 million that was given away last year was given away in thousands and thousands of donations, piece by piece.
The foundation has taken some criticism this year for some of the funds it manages. What are some of the issues that they've been involved in that have been drawing scrutiny?
Well, there's one specifically earlier this year. There was news coverage in a number of cities about donations by one of the foundation's clients to causes like population control and immigration restriction. And these are not what you would call progressive causes, which really most of the foundation's causes fit that description. Health, education, the arts, they're for progressives. But there are other kinds of people who give away money as well. And so this one client gave money to these causes that were in these areas that you may be hearing a lot right now under President Trump. And that caused a bit of an uproar, and people were wondering, you know, well, why is the foundation doing this? And Michael Marsicano told me that, you know, he has trouble sometimes. He has to explain to people what the difference is between money that the foundation controls itself, which is just a small piece of the annual donations, and money that the clients give away. And he talked about it this way.
We're a big tent. There are folks with fund holders who are quite conservative and folks who are fund holders who are quite liberal. And sometimes those fund holders actually contradict each other with the grants that they make. And that's what community is all about.
So am I hearing you say that in many cases, maybe in most cases, the actual donors decide where they want their money to go? Or are they guided by the foundation? Does the foundation pick and choose their own causes to support as well? How does that work?
But you're right on both of those. It's a good question. There, most of these funds that, like, for example, a family puts money into the foundation and they get a tax deduction and just decide where it's going to go, that's called a donor-advised fund. And it means that the donors themselves get to pick and choose where things go, as you described it. And then there is another set of funds that the foundation itself controls. This is money that it has made over the years. People, some of the clients have died and left money to the foundation. There are other donations that go directly to the foundation, and they call those their discretionary funds. And with those discretionary funds, they're able to support causes that the foundation's own community advisors tell them are needed. And that includes things like Project Lift in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, which has been targeting West Charlotte High School and its feeder schools, trying to get the graduation rate up there. It also targets other causes like the North Tryon Vision Plan that they did a couple of years ago and the current project that they're doing in Uptown Charlotte in the Carolina Theater.
We have about a minute left here. So how do those two projects, the North Tryon Redevelopment and the Carolina Theater, fit into the mission?
Well, you know, Marsicano talks about the civic betterment as being the main mission of the foundation. And if you remember what we talked about at the beginning, that $3,000 was meant to start a fund that would go to community needs. And, you know, obviously definitions change over time, but this one, the North Tryon area is one that has been ripe for redevelopment in Charlotte. And the foundation's headquarters are right up there, so it really fits into their backyard. They did get the Carolina Theater a couple of years ago for a very small amount, and they are redeveloping it right now. And they're working with a developer to build a 20-story hotel atop it. And the idea there is to contribute their little piece to the development of North Tryon Street.
David Borax from WFAE News. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Regional Partnership, which markets the 16-county, 2-state region known as Charlotte, USA, to companies looking to expand or relocate in our market. Information about supporting the effort at charlotteusa.com. And Gardner Webb University, a private Christian liberal arts experience dedicated to preparing students for success, now accepting summer and fall applications at gardner-webb.edu. Questions about Russian involvement in the 2016 election continue, but the meddling by the Kremlin in American politics is nothing new, according to former KGB agent Jack Barsky. So the Soviets planted Barsky in the U.S. in the late 1970s. This spy has come in from the cold to talk about his current tale of espionage, as well as what corporate America should glean from his experience as an enemy within, when Charlotte talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos suspends the crackdown on for-profit college abuses. What else is she up to? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up at 10, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tomorrow is Election Day in a pair of congressional districts, including the 5th District in South Carolina. That race has flown under the national radar when you compare it to tomorrow's other election outside Atlanta in Georgia's 6th Congressional District. The Democratic Party and others have poured millions into that contest, making it the most expensive special election in the House in history. The National Party has also given some attention to the South Carolina race, with a weekend visit recently from Party Chairman Tom Perez to campaign for nominee Archie Parnell, who faces an uphill climb in his bid to defeat Republican Ralph Norman. President Trump carried the South Carolina district by nearly 20 points last fall, and Norman has readily embraced the president. So is a Democratic upset realistic in the Palmetto State? Democrats notched better-than-expected results in other special elections this year, but they still lost those races. So while the South Carolina seat seems out of their hands, tomorrow's Georgia vote could be make or break for Democrats' hopes of flipping the House in the next year midterms. Here to talk about that race and other political news are Dr. Scott Huffman, professor of political science at Winthrop University and director of the Winthrop Poll, and Dr. Susan Roberts, a professor of political science at Davidson College. Both of them join us by phone. Morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning. How are you?
I'm good. So what is at stake? I'm going to start with you, Scott, because you're sitting there in South Carolina. What's at stake in tomorrow's election there?
Well, you know, I have to say that eyes for the National Democrats are really more heavily on the Georgia 6th district, and I think you alluded to that. And I do want to correct you. It's my understanding that it's not the most expensive special election, that this special election has reached the level of the most expensive House race, period.
Yes.
And when you think about that is absolutely insane that we're already pushing, I think, $60 million in a House race. I remember when Shelley Capito in West Virginia, everybody thought it was insane that it happened in West Virginia, spent $7 million on a House seat a few years back, and that was the most expensive, and we are utterly eclipsing that. But back to the 5th, you hit the nail on the head. It's sort of that Trump did so well here that even more than that, our congressman, former Congressman Mick Mulvaney, who was, of course, tapped to lead the Office of Management and Budget for Trump, which opened up this position, Mulvaney won by about 20 points. So he even outperformed Trump. And that sort of makes this almost out of the reach of Democrats, but they are extremely hopeful. The flip the 5th has been kind of going all over. But the truth be told, that's not really how the National Democrats are looking at it. There is a bit of a nod. Yes, Perez came down, but that was only after a whole lot of begging and cajoling on behalf of local Democrats. And the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee folks, they're the national Democratic group associated with Congress that try and elect members to the House for the Democratic Party. Their spending has been extremely limited, and frankly, actually, some of their spending has been a little wrong-headed. I'll give you one example. They paid for a flyer to go out targeted at African Americans in the 5th District. And it showed a picture of Donald Trump with his face kind of covered in red. So, you know, he's a little evil-looking, demonic-looking. And it basically said, don't let this happen again. And, you know, the implication, of course, is, oh, hey, black voters, Donald Trump's your fault. And, you know, and that, of course, is statistically not true. Everybody points, oh, well, black voting was down. Yeah, black voting was down compared to 2008-2012. But, you know, a Democrat was elected in the 90s when black voting was even lower than it is now, and the white share of the vote was even higher than it is now. So that's statistically incorrect. So even some of the limited spending the DCCC has been doing is really not particularly effective.
So
I've been told by a couple of Democrats inside the 5th District that they're kind of hearing that the DTRIP is treating them as an experiment of what's going to happen to Democratic voters if there's no added spending, you know, kind of this natural experiment between them and the Georgia 6th. And to be honest, here in the 5th, Archie Parnell is going to do extremely well, but extremely well probably means only losing by 8 to 10 points rather than the expected 20, and if you want to come back to why that's the case later, we of course can.
So when Susan Roberts, when we talk about all the special money flowing into both these races, it's just one seat. Even if the Democrats win, they're still in the minority in Congress. They can't really thwart GOP legislation. Given all of that, who has more to lose tomorrow in both those districts, the Democrats or the Republicans?
Well, I think for both these races, the Georgia 6 and South Carolina 5th, each party has raised the stakes way too high. The Democrats want to make it a referendum on Trump, and the Republicans want to say it's really this is the tenor of the race, these are good candidates, it's historically been drawn that way. One of the things that I think we ought to think about as you look back and at the Montana race with the GOP, the open seat, I believe it's Jan Fort, he really had what's going to be important? Is it money? Is it, you won't want to call it a scandal. He's the candidate that body slammed a reporter and still won the race, and that happened a couple of days ahead of time. Now, in both that race, and in Georgia, and Scott can correct me about South Carolina, what happened is the early voting, the early turnout made a difference. I think that the race, and not just to dwell on the Georgia race, but I think it's fascinating. I think it has a lot of the ingredients that we may see the next time around. How much money can win a seat? How much is it an anti-Trump race? Ossoff has not just attracted national money. He's gone out to solicit teams of youth, college students to come from North Carolina, Virginia, South Carolina, to help work on his campaign, to be volunteers at some level, but also to pay their expenses. And this is an incredible use of money that goes beyond just how much you're going to spend for a certain election in terms of ad buys and getting out the vote or the size of the office. I just think that that has a lot of ingredients. My bottom line on that race is that if it takes over $60 million for either side to win a race, then 2018 is going to be really unrealistic for the Democrats and the Republicans because, as we know, the Republicans have gotten a leg up on spending in the past. I just think that race and the South Carolina race, and I hate to say this for your listeners, the dog days of summer are not these two races, along with everything that's going on in D.C. and being played out about the special counsel. It may be the best time for Donald Trump, but people are watching, even when they're trying to think about what am I going to do July 4th.
These are, I'm not sure these are apples and apples races, the Georgia election here and the South Carolina election, but clearly the Democratic Party has got to do something because they're out of power in Washington and they're out of power in the majority of state legislatures around the country. So it has to begin at this level, it seems to me, or below. Am I wrong about that, to regain any kind of traction? And if so, what has been the message in these two races? What are Democratic candidates saying to either woo back Democrats who've slid into the independent and Republican category, or to parlay what is going on in Washington with Donald Trump into something that's meaningful for people in their district?
Well, I think we could all three agree. It is how much of the Trump message are you for? Where do you want to position yourself? I know in Montana, the winning GOP candidate said, "I am all in with Trump." He engaged in insults. His campaigning was very aggressive. I think Ossoff in the Georgia 6 has been more moderate and more centrist and has not fully embraced this, "My platform is anti-Trump." And Scott, what has been the central focus in South Carolina?
Yeah, well, I do want to correct one thing. While Republicans, you know, do control the presidency and both chambers of Congress, clearly they still control the deep state if you follow Twitter at all. So, you know, I guess they've got that.
Yeah,
I couldn't even get that out. So, in South Carolina, in the 5th, you know, Trump is definitely was a central part of the original primary. The Republicans, in fact, spent a whole lot of time trying to discover who was the Trumpiest of the Trumpers and out-Trump each other. And it sometimes literally came down to that, who was going to support the president the most. And, you know, in the end, the runoff came down to Tommy Pope and Ralph Norman. Ralph Norman obviously won and is the Republican candidate. Two things that Ralph Norman said he is the best way to continue Mick Mulvaney. He said, if you liked Mick Mulvaney, if you like Trump, you'll love me. He said that over and over. He said he would join the Freedom Caucus to support every vote that Mulvaney would have voted, whereas Pope said, you know, "I don't know whether I'll join the Freedom Caucus or not. I like to take each vote as to whether or not it's best for the 5th District." And he lost. He lost in that primary. And so the two things that caused Pope to lose kind of in that close runoff were not saying he was the strongest for Trump, and an incredible spending campaign by Norman, just labeling him over and over as a lawyer, you know, out for money. So this, on the Republican side, has been very much about Trump. On the Democratic side, a little less so, although, you know, kind of Trump hangs over everything they're doing. The motivation of the base in South Carolina's 5th District has been the highest I've seen since I've lived here. They didn't need to be very motivated while John Spratt held office.
Yeah.
He held that office on the basis of name recognition and amazing constituent service, well into a time when it was kind of leaning Republican in every other way, and frankly on his fiscal conservatism. Until he had to take the chair of the Budget Committee under Obama and push some of Obama's stuff, he was a fiscal conservative in his votes, and anybody says otherwise hasn't really looked at his votes. He did flip there at the end, but, you know, Democrats didn't have to be very active then. And after that, it sort of hasn't been a well-oiled machine, to say the least. And so Trump really spurred the activism among the Democrats in the 5th District here and really motivated them. And there, folks, I was talking to somebody yesterday who said that they were out canvassing with kids from Ohio who had come down and were trying to flip the 5th. And maybe they'd have a better chance if they'd have gone to the 6th in Georgia.
Well, who had greater voter turnout in the primary, Republicans or Democrats?
Republicans, but that's for two reasons. One, it was kind of there were a lot more people involved, and so there was a lot more activity and money being spent to get them out. And again, because of demographics, they're just more Republicans here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things I've tried to explain to people why the South Carolina 5th is not the Georgia 6th, we're just not purple in this district.
No, they're red.
Yeah, we're deeply red. And that was beginning to be true under John Spratt. It's just, again, John Spratt was unique in holding it. And here's why. Even up through 2010, the South Carolina 5th District was a little over 29% black voting age population. It was a little higher than that African-American population in general, but black voting age population, it was 29%. Research shows that you need over 30%, usually in the mid-30s, to get a white Democrat in a district. After the census, of course, South Carolina got a new congressional district, the 7th. The 7th district, where they centered it around Myrtle Beach, then inland, ate into some of the 5th district's African-American population. They deliberately gerrymandered some of the black population out and shoved it into our majority-minority district, 6th, Jim Clyburn's district. And so the black voting age population in the 5th district in South Carolina went from 29% to 26%, making it even harder for a Democrat to win. So this district became even redder with fewer African Americans, plus the demographic growth has been all centered in York County. There are 11 counties that are either wholly or partially in the 5th district, but York County's population overwhelms them, and most of the in-migration into York County has been middle class, upper middle class, and wealthier whites who often jump the border from Charlotte, living in the Tigakay, Lake Wylie, Baxter area, Fort Mill, some retirees, of course, down in the Panhandle near Indian Land of the Lancaster County. But the fact is, a lot of them live with their backs to South Carolina. They're South Carolinians in name and voting only.
And property taxes.
And price, right, yeah. Jump the border for the lower taxes. And, there is a strong Democratic base, but there's a stronger Republican base.
And in that race, you have a Republican, a very conservative Republican, Ralph Norman, with a track record because he was in the state legislature for so long. And as he has said himself, he will vote the way Mick Mulvaney voted. So if you like Mick, you're going to like him and what he plans to do if he gets to Washington. On the other hand, you have, like the president, an amateur politician, a first-time person running for office, Archie Parnell on the Democratic side. But at the same time, he also has tax credentials. And if taxes or tax cuts or tax policy is important, he might be able to do something in that area because he understands the tax code, or so he says. What role, if any, will that play?
Well, his area of expertise actually, I think, would play a better role in a general election. And I'll explain why that is likely to come about. But, he's a fascinating, he's really intelligent. He's been a pretty good candidate. He's not exciting, but I don't think you ever usually use the word exciting with
he has great ads.
Tax expert. Yeah. The Norman campaign kind of, message tested stuff against him. Oh, he spent time in China. Oh, he helped corporations keep their money. And it's sort of, that's the kind of thing. It's wait. Well, a Republican would probably be okay with that part. One of the ones they tested against him was, hey, when he moved to South Carolina, he designed part of his house to look Chinese, or I say he put a pagoda garden in or something like that. But Archie Parnell really is a smart guy.
And let me stop you there because we have to take a break. Scott Huffman from Winthrop University. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and SunTrust Bank, providing tools and information to help people take a step towards financial confidence. SunTrust Bank, member FDIC. And Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Jersey Boys, the story of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, July 5th through the 9th at Belk Theater. Tickets available at 704-372-1000. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on Point here on WFAE, Jane Clayson is in for Tom Ashbrook, where the conversation turns to education and Betsy DeVos's vision for American education's future. She's recently suspended the crackdown on for-profit college abuses. Hannah will discuss that and more on Point. coming up at 10, here on 90.7 WFAE.
Between meetings, appointments, reminders, staying in tune with the news can seem tough.
It was a truck bomb.
Wants the Supreme Court to lift an injunction that bars the government.
NPR News checks the facts and adds background so you know what's going on. You understand why and maybe what it means. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
News you can trust from 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Scott Huffman, professor of political science at Winthrop University, and Dr. Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College. Susan, there have been these other races, these interim, in-between races around the country in which Democrats have either won the seat or they've come close, with Republicans still taking the seat or retaining the seat, shall we say. Is that something that Republicans should be concerned about and that Democrats should take heart in because they see a shifting tide?
Well, I guess I'm not too optimistic for the Democrats that they see a shifting tide, at least right now. I think that the clock on politics right now is not moving at the same pace, so to speak, as it has in the past. Every day when we're looking at Trump, there's more and more skepticism about how he's running his presidency. I want to add one thing and then come back to this about South Carolina is, as far as I understand, the two candidates are putting their own money into it. So money is going to be a question going forward, as well as in these races. If you look at other races, to what is the impact on redistricting? Spratt never had a safe seat, and it was redistricted even more red, as Scott says. But as far as the other races go, I think it's just going to look at whether these candidates are recruited versus self-recruited. You haven't seen that in Georgia. They haven't been picked by the party. So these other races, if the party's going to pick a candidate, it may have an impact. If the Democrats see how expensive the race is, and I think to the degree to which you can look and see, again, as I said, the anti-Trump sentiment, but the money. We had this last week, the question of civility and stopping this extra money and pledging to run a positive campaign. And this was from that rhetoric was from a Republican being interviewed about the post-baseball problem and a return to civility. And I think that's going to be short-lived. I think we're still going to see this outside money. And I think some of the things that are going to really determine all these races in the fall are going to be money and turnout and redistricting. And I think if you looked at each of those are the things that you could say, this points to this race, this points to that. I'd like to point out that some of these questions, say in Georgia right now, they're running neck and neck. I don't know what the numbers are in South Carolina. But the polling, the question of polling and the what extent that we need to look at that. Scott does a great job with the Winthrop poll in South Carolina. And I think, the questions about Trump says, oh, the Rasmussen poll is the best out there. It's really great. I think that you look at some of the quality of the polls, they vary widely.
Talk about the Rasmussen poll, because President Trump does rather well in that. I think his approval rating's at 50% in that, which is high so far for his presidency.
But it's not been, when they have groups like some of the groups that investigate and give polling firms ratings, they don't come in very well on the basis of how they select, whether it's voters, potential voters. Scott can speak to that. I don't think it's one of the ones that's graded the highest in terms of transparency and methodology.
Well, the thing about the Rasmussen poll, especially when it comes to their general population polls, as opposed to, let's set aside their election polls for a second, but, Rasmussen's a primarily robo-poll outfit. Which means you can only call robo-poll, you can only be called by robo-poll if you have a landline. And, nationally, it's around 50% of the people do not have a landline. They are cell-only.
Yeah.
and another, you know, almost 25-30% are sell mostly. So it's hard to get those people. And one of the recent ones that talked about the Rasmussen poll with Trump at 50% is Vox. Vox.vox.com actually showed its trend, and it showed where Rasmussen always was. Rasmussen always shows the Republican higher, it's a Republican-leaning organization, and it has always shown Trump higher. But even beyond that, this one poll is an extreme outlier. So
yes,
you can go and look at the Vox average. And so trends are usually the best thing. Even the best polls are sometimes off, which is why trend lines are good, a good thing to look at. But Susan's right, transparency is key. And unfortunately, one of the best at this was HuffPollster, part of the Huffington Post. They just had to lay off a bunch of their poll folks, and they were one of the organizations who said they would only accept polls whose methodology they could verify. And so it's organizations like that when you look at the polling. And there hasn't been much in the 5th District. What little there has been coming out of the two campaigns themselves, which you always have to take with a grain of salt. It's not that they're wrong, but they may have select the outlier, like Trump selected the outlier for his recent poll. You know, if a poll is coming out of a campaign and you realize they're doing polls, rolling polls every week, and we've only heard about this one, think to yourself, why have we heard this one? So the one poll that here in the 5th District, Archie Parnell, the Democrat, has released is the one showing him merely down by 10 points to show how well he's doing. And we really haven't heard that much from the Ralph Norman campaign. But when it comes to polling, that's why Rasmussen tends to be a little higher and why you should look at trends in answer to that question.
So, well, the trends are for Trump that his numbers have gotten higher. Unfortunately, they're the disapproval numbers.
Yeah. That's
true. Susan, Democrats are really trying to glom onto the fact that people are unhappy with Donald Trump, or the news coming out of Washington is casting aspersions, possible aspersions, on the Trump campaign and people involved in the Trump administration, etc. This doesn't seem to bother a lot of Trump fans, and maybe even some mainline Republicans, because they're happy that he's there and they're happy that they control the House and the Senate and the White House. So is this a false hope on the part of Democrats? Are there enough people out there who care about the possible problems with Donald Trump and his people?
Well, I think this is a period in which we still have to parse the base and the sentiment by lawmakers and how they're going to take this message back to the district, the Republican lawmakers. I think it is a little bit of a false hope for the Democrats to think that is that's going to propel them, because the next several months might make a difference. But I would hazard to guess that all the problems with Donald Trump and whether or not he's under investigation for obstruction of justice, these may not be the kind of questions that will be resolved, or at least, still have the same shelf life in 2018. And I think the Democrats do need to focus on not just the Trump disapproval ratings, but Trump is operating. One of the key elements is to roll back the Obama legacy, whether it be in Cuba or with health care or environmental regulations. And the Democrats need to address some of those issues, yeah, and not just the unpopularity of Donald Trump. You remember with Bill Clinton, people didn't like him, but they liked the job he was doing. His personal approval ratings after the scandal with Monica Lewinsky plummeted, but his job approval ratings were pretty good.
Mm-hmm. The tail has the people have said that the tail has been wagging the dog in the Republican Party, that the arch conservatives have really taken control of the party and caused it to make a far turn to the right, and a lot of people like that. On the other hand, the Democrats are kind of having an inter intramural war among themselves, because in Georgia, for instance, John Ossoff is kind of a middle-of-the-road candidate. I think maybe Archie Parnell in South Carolina could be described that way as well. And there's a faction of the Democratic Party that wants to go much farther to the left, so we'd have a left versus far-right contest in some of these areas. Is that going to happen, or are Democrats going to stick to the middle of the road?
I don't think it's going to happen in a lot of these places, because you see what happened here in the 5th District and in the 6th. And, you know, as you pointed out, both of these are kind of among the more moderate candidates. Now, one thing you have seen in that is the control of the county parties. And I don't know if it's come up in the same with the district parties, but in county parties around the country, you've seen that exact fight that you were talking about of sort of the Bernie-type folks kind of against the Hillary-type folks, you know, the kind of more far to the left, populist left, inside, you know, political insiders trying to gain control over the traditional, you know, Democratic voters, which were the classic Hillary Clinton voters. But as you had asked earlier about whether or not, you know, what was this, the harbinger for Democrats in the future, and I think Susan was nailing it on the head. We don't know yet how they're going to respond, because the folks aren't exactly responding in the way you would think to all the accusations about Trump. It's really not affecting his base. His popularity is in the high 80s, 90s among his core voters. So, you know, the unpopularity is driven obviously by Democrats and moderates, but not his core base. I think the canaries in the coal mine, I think the 6th may be a bit of one. I do not think the 5th is, it can be used for predictive purposes. But it's the governor's race in Virginia that we should watch closely. And then in 2018, what the Democrats need to focus on are what of Trump's agenda has passed. Because right now, nothing. He's essentially passed no legislation. As Susan pointed out, his agenda thus far, with executive orders and the things he can do from the Oval Office, tend to be at erasing the legacy of Barack Obama. I actually am wondering if somebody's going to slip up and make an accidental racist statement, say, you know, we're trying to get rid of the dark stain of the Obama presidency or something like that, because it seems, as Susan said, that he seems to be singularly driven with getting rid of whatever Obama had done. But if they get some legislation through and it actually hurts some of the folks who were core supporters of Donald Trump, then in 2018, Democrats will have something to capitalize other than, hey, we don't like this guy.
But Democrats seem to be, you mentioned Virginia, Democrats seem to be fired up, because in the primary for governor last week, I think it was in Virginia, Democratic turnout was the largest ever for a non-presidential primary.
Getting Democrats fired up across a country where you have a lot of gerrymandered districts is not enough. Yes, the Democratic base has to turn out in huge numbers in order to defeat the Republican, but they also have to convert some voters. In Republican-drawn districts, all the Republicans have to do is stay the course, kind of turn out their base. And if the Democrats turn out their base, they still lose. So you're right, the Democrats are fired up, and the anti-Trump rhetoric is working for them, but they also have to convert voters, and that's going to take Trump doing something that affects them directly, rather than, you know, them thinking, oh, I don't like him as a person.
Well, John Ossoff in Georgia, Susan Roberts, has been courting Republican voters and courting independents. What has he been saying, and what does a Democrat need to say to overcome all the obstacles that Scott Huffman just talked about?
Well, I think he needs to look at the character of the district, which is has been redrawn a bit to favor some of the new, the urban millennial vote. But I think, you know, what Scott pointed out, and I think we need to think about when he mentioned the county offices, is what's going on at the infrastructure. And that is, I think it was in March, a federal judge said, I'm opening up registration again for people to register to vote for this primary. And so many things are going on, not just in that race, but if you look at registration and the voting rights changes, if you look at the redistricting, and if you want to look, you know, at the big picture, in 2018, the Democrats have to defend twice as many Senate seats as the Republicans. So we may be talking about turning one district or the other, or maybe two or three or a handful, but that may not be nearly enough to give the Democrats any majority. And I think, you know, if I were a betting person, and I do now and then, I think I'd bet on the Republicans retaining both the House and the Senate. And in the long run, that's going to be something that might mute all the things we're talking about if at the last stretch we're talking about impeachment. I have seen, interestingly enough, several articles about what if Pence were president? And I don't think there's, you know, any reason to start reading that right now. But there's just some weird things going on in Washington. That cabinet meeting that everybody, you know, just scratched their heads and say, what does this mean? And so I think the numbers and the approval rating and the degree to which candidates in these districts can look at that and say, this is how it's going to play. I might just throw in one thing. If we look at races across the country, and the top of the ticket and the left and the centrist, I think the Democratic Party needs to get a little younger in some of these candidates. You know, talk about Joe Biden and any kind of Sanders wing is really overstated at this point.
They're planning to hold this late-night protest, Democrats are, in Washington tonight, as Republicans work on their health care bill, one that the president now calls mean. If they bring the Senate to a halt, how will that be seen? And I have 15 seconds.
Well, right now I think it would be misguided to bring it forth because you've seen a number of people that say, let's hold on, let's relook at it. So I think that the protest may not be any good. I think it's the constituents back home, how you read your constituents.
Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College. Scott Huffman is a professor of political science at Winthrop University, our north-south perspective here. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.